a network of ideas. RN, on air, on your phone, and online.
On RN or online at abc.net.au. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, anxiety. We all feel it to some degree, but what exactly is it? And what should we do when those anxious feelings take hold? To explore these and many other questions around anxiety, our expert panellists this evening are Associate Professor Adam Guastella, a clinical psychologist and principal research fellow at the Brain and Mind Research Institute at Sydney University. Genevieve David, the president of the Australian Association of Buddhist Counsellors and Psychotherapists. Nick Malpas teaches philosophy at the University of Sydney. And Kerry Sackville is columnist, social commentator and author of The Little Book of Anxiety, Confessions from a Worried Life. And now to the ethics of anxiety. This roundtable discussion is presented by the St. James Ethics Centre, and our moderator is the centre's event curator, Jackie Dent.
I mean, clearly anxiety is a problem that has persisted for centuries, and philosophers and thinkers have been, you know, had tried to help people with their struggle with anxiety. Can you tell us a bit about how modern philosophers have looked at anxiety? What are they saying about it?
Sure. Well, just before I get on to what modern philosophers have said about that, and they were mostly concerned with existential philosophers, or what are called existentialists, us philosophers like to ask the question, you know, what is the nature of X when we first approach something? So I'd like to start by doing that, asking what is anxiety and doing kind of a bit of phenomenology about it. That is, looking at what is the experience of anxiety like. And I think it's helpful here to distinguish anxiety from the emotion of fear. In fear, you experience, you know, heightened heart rate and various other physiological responses because of some imminent threat. Yeah, it might be a threat to something you value, a threat to your life, any kind of threat. With anxiety, it's slightly different. There, the threat isn't imminent. It's not something that is immediately threatening to you. Even in the case of specific phobias like agoraphobia, social phobia, and so on, it's not, you know, the presence of other people itself isn't threatening. It's you're anxious about what might happen in that social context. And I think looking at anxiety in that way, as being about something that isn't even present, something that you only imagine, shows that anxiety is linked to a number of distinctively human features. There are, of course, you can, of course, have anxiety in animals, and you can induce anxiety in animals just by exposing them to chronic stress. But in humans, anxiety has a large element of reflection, and that can mean, you know, an internal monologue, or it can mean thinking in terms of images, sometimes, you know, catastrophic thoughts, and so on. And what's important here to realize is that what you're anxious about is essentially the future. You're anxious about what might happen. A subset of that you could see as being anxious about what other people think about you or what other people feel, but really you're anxious about that because you're anxious about what they might do based on their feelings and thoughts. So the source of anxiety is really uncertainty about what might happen. And that uncertainty causes some kind of insecurity, a feeling of insecurity. So for a philosopher, I think this is very interesting because it shows that we feel anxiety because we're able to be aware of our own uncertainty, we're able to reflect on our own states of mind, and in the case of social anxiety, we're able to take up the perspectives of other people and to understand what they might think or feel about us. So, you know, this shows that anxiety is connected to our capacity for reflection, our capacity to imagine the future, to imagine things that don't actually exist, to plan for the future, and our capacity for social understanding, empathy, and so on. In terms of the modern philosophers, the big names there are Søren Kierkegaard, 19th century Danish philosopher, Martin Heidegger, early 20th century German philosopher, and Jean-Paul Sartre. And what's common to all three of those thinkers is that they connect anxiety very closely with human freedom. They all see anxiety as being that feeling in which our freedom is manifest to us. And in Kierkegaard, he links that feeling of our freedom specifically to sin. He thinks that in anxiety we have an experience that we're able to do something, but that thing is also forbidden. That is, it's a sin or it's a wrongdoing. And in that feeling of anxiety, where it's also revealed to us that we could act in a wrong way or a right way. That is, we could sin or refrain from sinning, and thereby it reveals our freedom to us. For Heidegger, and Heidegger draws a lot of his thoughts on anxiety from Kierkegaard, he thinks that usually when we go about our lives, we're just kind of caught up in what everybody does. We just go along with the crowd. We just do what's habit, what's conventional. But in anxiety, we have an experience of ourselves as radically separated from, you know, the conventional way of doing things, separated from the crowd. And we're thrown back on ourselves and forced to own up to our existence and own up to the fact that we choose what we're going to be. So you can see there the close connection between anxiety and freedom. Anxiety, although it is a very unpleasant experience, Heidegger thinks it's something that we have to embrace, because it's only through that feeling that we can really realize our being, Heidegger would say, as, his term is ability to be, that is, as having the capacity to be this or that, to choose what path we're going to take in our lives.
I mean, Genevieve, I mean, going back a few centuries and in terms of the Buddha, as I think a lot of people here probably wouldn't really be aware about the notion of Buddhism and the combination with psychotherapy. Can you talk a bit about what your practice involves?
Well, I was listening to you going, wow, there's a lot of Buddhism in there. And Buddhism is so old. So the way the Buddha would look at anxiety and how it can be helpful in psychotherapy to use Buddhism is this idea of the First Noble Truth, which is that idea of dukkha. And dukkha is this inevitable, the idea that suffering is inevitable, that we all suffer, and being human, having human bodies, we're going to suffer. And dukkha literally means difficult, and kha means the axle of the wheel that's not fitting. So the idea in Buddhism is that life is a bumpy road. And in the Second Noble Truth, it would be that life's a bumpy road and I want it to be different. I want it to be something other than a bumpy road. You know, and that's the suffering. That's where suffering comes in. And dukkha, there are three kinds of dukkha. The first dukkha is actually just dukkha of existence. So our birth, aging, illness, death, the inevitability of that. It's how we view that causes the suffering or anxiety. Then the second one is our resistance to change. And we really don't like change. And so we want things, we kind of try to hold on to things, whereas Buddhism would say we just have to be with it as it is. And the third would be the existential anxiety that we all feel, which is, you know, very much like that, but this sort of the insubstantiality of existence, that it's like a dream, that we're living in something like a dream, and that causes a level of anxiety.
So Adam, in terms of the latest science, I mean, moving away from, I guess, the more theoretical realm of philosophy and Buddha, I mean, in terms of science, how these days, I suppose, anxiety is pathologized. It's seen as, you know, an individual problem. Can you tell us about what are some of the latest science that you've been looking into about why people do get anxiety?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that anxiety necessarily itself has been pathologized. Anxiety is a normal human response. It's something that you and I experience to varying degrees, but it has depending on its chronicity and its impact, it has an impact on your functioning at different levels. And when it has an impact on your functioning and your distress levels to a very severe degree, that's when we start saying, well, it needs treatment, and that's at a pathological level. So I wouldn't say anxiety itself is pathological, but there are certainly habits and you know, patterns that we fall into, which cause us lots of distress and impairments in functioning. And from a scientific point of view, we know that anxiety doesn't really operate in the same way as making typical decisions. So we know that if I was to give you, say, $1,000, and I was to say to you, with that $1,000, I want you to go and make as much money from that for the next year and give me the change. We probably need more than $1,000 to entice you into it. But anyway, you would sit down and look at, weigh up the pros and the cons and the risks and find the right investment and decide yourself what was the best approach to take with that money, and then a year later come back to me and justify what you've done. Now, we know that that type of thinking, that sort of planning, that decision, that what we call goal-directed way of thinking, it just is not anxiety at all. You see the spider, you think that spider's going to bite me, I'm going to lose control, I can't cope. You're not even aware of the thought sometimes, you just get the experience of anxiety. It's a habit, it's fast, it's automatic. And what we understand with anxiety is that those circuits underlying that process, they're ancient circuits, they're old circuits, they're circuits that were developed in the well before, if you like, the thinking, the goal-directed circuits, what we call the cortex. So, you know, the circuits are habitual and they're patterned. And so a lot of the work that we do is trying to understand how we can change habits and patterns and reactions and really start to reveal some of the thoughts that might be and predictions that are embedded in those circuits. So from a science point of view, we're looking at learning and how people learn about and learn habits and change their habits, and we look at different treatments to try and alter their learning patterns, and you know, the most common being cognitive behaviour therapy, most widely known. But you know, that's primarily where the field is at right now.
And what about you, Kerry? How would you articulate your construction of your own anxiety as a self-described anxious person?
You know, it's so interesting listening to all the theories and all the background, and there's so much that I can relate to, but there's a lot that I can't relate to as well. And I think I mentioned once to Nick before we even started these panels is that I can hear all the philosophizing about what anxiety means and you know, different constructions of it from philosophical points of view, but to me it just feels like an intensely personal experience. And as an anxious person, it doesn't really help to see it in the context of our own freedom or you know, moral choices or whatever, because it's almost indistinguishable to me from fear. The only thing that's different is the stimulus. So I'll give you an example. I'm much better with my anxiety now after years and years and years of therapy and hard work. But it's catastrophic thoughts, and it is exactly what Adam said. You're not even aware of them happening. So that, for example, you know, I'm a freelance writer, and I might submit a piece to an editor for publication, and it might get rejected for whatever reason. And even if I've had 50 pieces published in the year already, that's the end. My career's over, and I can see that, and I start thinking about what I can do. Can I become a barista? Can I become a pastry chef? Maybe I can work in a bookshop because I like books. And it's going on and on. It's taken a long time for me to say, hang on, that's a catastrophic thought. That's your anxiety speaking. And I now, because you know, I do public speaking and I go on TV and I'm used to those things, so I can get the normal kind of rush of, I suppose you'd call it concern, that I'm not going to stuff up, I'm not going to say anything inappropriate, I'm not going to swear. And I can manage that. But then you get me at home and my cat brings in a rat and my whole, what is it, parasympathetic nervous system goes ballistic. And before I can think, I'm standing on a chair screaming with my three children kind of gathered around me looking to mummy for calm. And I'm like, fuck! I just swore. I just did it, didn't I? I just swore in the talk, which I just said I wouldn't. But, you know, I'm screaming hysterically and have to call my 70-year-old mother to come and rescue me because I have completely lost control. And that's anxiety. And so in that context, I don't care what you know, Sartre said or what anybody else says. It's very real. And the only thing that will help me is almost to develop the capacity over many years to be able to stand outside myself and say, okay, this isn't a real threat. this is something that, for whatever reason, my brain has tricked me into thinking is a real threat. You know, this is a rat. It's not going to kill me. It's not going to bite me. It's just triggered something in me. And it was the same when I used to get into lifts, and I had a lift phobia, and I'd imagine that the lift was plummeting to my death. And if the doors didn't open immediately, I'd start screaming because I was sure that I was going to be trapped in there, and there's going to be a fire, and I'm going to die. And you know, it's your brain. You're losing control of your brain, and to me it's less about choices, which I find really interesting what Nick said, less about the choices that we have and more about the lack of choices. It's about feeling out of control. If I can control something, I'm not anxious about it. If I can manage everything myself, but if I have to relinquish control to someone else or to fate, for example, I find that incredibly difficult to sit with, and it's something that I have to learn to do, and that to me is the core of my anxiety.
Could I just comment on that briefly? I wouldn't argue with anything that you say, but just say that anxiety as feeling out of control, that implies that you want to be in control and that you can be in control, and that's precisely what I'm was trying to get at by talking about human freedom and owning up to your way
well,
of
I think
being,
it's more, there are certain things you can be profoundly anxious about that you know you'll never have control over. Health, for example. And, you know, I can try and control my own health, but I've got three children. Anyone who's a parent or anybody who's loved anybody, aside from children, will know that you have so much at stake in this other person, and you can be terrified of losing that person, and you know you have no control over that. And that can be a terrible source of anxiety. It's something that you have to learn to live with every single time you say goodbye to that person. So certain things we want to control and we think we should be able to control, certain things we know we can't control, it can be equally as powerful a source of distress, I think. I'd love to be able to control everything. I'd love to control the world, all of you, you know, this this room. That would make my life much easier. Not necessarily for you, but for me.
Writer, columnist and self-described anxious person, Kerry Sackville. Across Australia on RN, you're with Big Ideas. And tonight, a roundtable discussion on anxiety with psychologist Adam Guastella, philosopher Nick Malpas, and clinical psychotherapist and Buddhist Genevieve David. Back to the St James Ethics Centre and our moderator, Jackie Dent.
In terms of, I guess, some of the ethical issues surrounding anxiety, I mean, obviously anxiety does serve some sort of purpose. It's a sign, you know, we need it in terms, you know, things that we do get scared about naturally. Mm. Adam, I'm interested to ask you that, you know, if there was, I mean, you obviously treat, or Genevieve, you both treat people who have anxiety. I mean, if we could rid the world of anxiety, do you think we should?
Definitely not. I don't have a full answer to this, but I think the panel can cover this question really well. From a Buddhist perspective, anxiety, as I just said, is actually just part of living. It's part of living with the idea that we're all going to die. I mean, that's one thing we know. Everyone in this room is going to die at one point. And chances are we're going to get sick. But I think, yeah, anxiety is really important for human connection. We actually, without it, and there was a really good example, someone suggested I take a beta blocker because I never speak publicly. So why don't you take half a beta blocker? And this other person said, who's an acting coach, said, you're going to, if you take them, what happens is you lose something of your vulnerability, which is what's important when you're speaking to people because you lose, you know, you need to connect. So I think, in answer to your question, I think anxiety, I have lots of answers, my mind is going in 100 million directions, but what I say is no, that we need it. We need it to connect. When it's out of control, we're no longer connecting. But there are ways, if we can bring it and we can rein it in and just, as you do, connect with people through it, then, yeah, isn't that better than just... Then I go into sort of sci-fi films, you know, those automatons, you know, who don't feel. So, yeah, I'd say no. That's my answer.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd say we need anxiety in our lives. It's part of being human, and it's not something that we should try to eradicate. There are probably two examples. One is that from a genetic point of view, we know that some people are more susceptible to anxiety generally. You know, there's no specific gene for a specific disorder or behaviour, I should say. But there are genes which make us more susceptible to stress and arousal. But when we look at the types of groups that cluster around that, there's lots of positive things about that group too. You know, they can tend to be more artistic and compassionate, and there's a whole range of things. It's not all negative, you know. The second thing I'd say is that I do see clients every now and then that have a great life. You know, they report everything being right in their life. And they say to me, Adam, I'm still feeling anxious. I want it to stop. Can you make me not feel anxiety at all? And they'll say they're doing the exercise, they're eating right, they've got the right job, they've got the right relationship and the family, but they still get stressed. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but depending on the case, I'm not generalising to everyone, but in a lot of these cases, I just go, well, you know, it's I don't do it in therapy, I don't say it this way, but bad luck. Yeah. You know, we need anxiety, and it's something we have to accept as a part of ourselves and to learn to tolerate so much of our energy. And a lot of the problems that emerge with anxiety begin when we start to try and push it away. Push it away through drugs, push it away through avoidance, push it away through some other mechanism that isn't about accepting. And that's when we start to get into real problems. So I think that, no, I don't want to take a pill to take it away. And you know, and it also provides signals about growth opportunities, I think. Mm-hmm. As Genevieve. I haven't got the French accent, I'm sorry.
But Kerry, would you, I mean, you? I think you'd take the pill.
I don't take medication for anxiety. If I ever do, I've occasionally tried to take a Xanax or a Valium, which has a great effect on my anxiety because I become unconscious, and it's very hard to feel anxious when you're unconscious. It's also very hard to do anything else when you're unconscious. For me, again, with the I wouldn't want to ever take a medication that would get rid of my levels of concern or my ability to have, you know, regular run-of-the-mill worry. I think it's important to get a bit of a rush before you go and sit in front of a group of people or you know, when you've got a child, you want to make sure that they're taken care of and so on. But anything above that, I would get rid of it in a second if I could without side effects because, and I understand why, you know, your clients would come to you and say, make it go away. It is the most unpleasant feeling, this hideous, prickling, sick feeling in your chest, and you can't rest, and your mind is going a million miles an hour, and it stops being at all productive. And I know people talk about their anxiety feeding their ambition and feeding their desire for self-improvement and to get ahead. But I personally think the two can be separated. I think that I can feel ambition without then feeling that terrible, terrible anxiety if something is out of my control or doesn't go well. And, you know, once you get beyond, you know, when you're crossing a road, for example, you want to feel a certain level of concern and anxiety, because if you don't look around you and watch out for cars and other people, you could end up flat on the road. But if you're standing by the side of the road so terrified you can't actually move, clearly that's not helpful. And so anything beyond that point, yeah, take it away. Give me the pill. Drugs.
But see, from a therapist...
Or therapy. Sorry, or therapy's good too.
Thank you. From a therapist's point of view, I would say we would learn our way out of it.
Yeah, you know, and you can. You definitely
As opposed to, you know, we know that Xanax and, you know, the Valium and the they are highly abused drugs, addictive, and they make anxiety worse.
Yeah, in the long term they do, definitely. And it is possible. I mean, I'm a living example of the fact that it is possible to get therapy and to change your behaviours, but it does take a lot of work and it takes a good therapist. And I went through about three or four before I found someone who could actually help and sort of sits with me. She's on my shoulder all the time. And when I have a catastrophic thought, I can hear her say, Kerry, this isn't real. This is your anxiety speaking. And I listen to her. She's part of me now, and it's that's been my saviour, I think. Mm-hmm.
And one thing we haven't talked about, can I just briefly say, anxiety, we're talking about this kind of anxiety with this sort of bodily response, but there's in psychodynamic theory, we would say that anxiety is actually a signal that there are certain feeling states or certain affects or emotions, however you want to call them, that sit sort of almost unexplored or untapped or that haven't really been expressed in primary years. So, for example, because our parents couldn't tolerate a certain feeling, then that gets shut off so that you stay in connection with your parent or caregiver. So So these things, what we would say is that they're like a bit like toothpaste, you know, when you keep the lid on and you've got holes, you know, it just squirts out everywhere. So that would be, that's also an important reason where anxiety can also come from. Yeah, it's not, so it's an internal danger. So you don't, the saber-toothed tiger isn't out there, but actually in here. And I see a lot of people, for example, particularly women, who really struggle with anger. You know, it's not a feminine affect. Now, today, it's becoming a lot more so. But it's just not feminine to get really angry. And so we don't really have the ways in which to express anger. So a lot of women come in and they're anxious, but it's because they haven't really ever learned to say, to be outraged, or to say no, or to sort of do this. So, yeah, that's another reason for anxiety, I think, and that's where, yeah, therapy, really, that's where long-term psychotherapists, we go looking for those feelings that haven't been expressed yet, or haven't had a voice yet, which kind of create this anxiety.
I mean, it's interesting you raise this issue about, you know, we live in a society where, okay, women can't be angry. And I think part of the thing that I find interesting about sort of more broader, I guess, some of the ethics around our social responsibility, that how do we, you know, help people with anxiety, or how, you know, we are all feeling anxious. Like, for example, you know, in France, they've now banned skinny models on the catwalk. Obviously, there was... in French culture, there was an issue. It was creating anxiety in people about their body image. You know, we have a lot of people who get quite disturbed by social media and the comment processes on Facebook, and you know, it can really, really just stress them out. I mean, are there? You know, I guess you know, socially, do we have some sort of ethical duty? I guess like what the French government has done about the model issue is quite fascinating. Like, are there things happening in society that we can address to perhaps sort of reduce some of these broader anxious levels?
I mean, one thing that struck me is that I think there probably is some link between gender and gender roles and, you know, narratives about gender and the higher rates of anxiety that you get amongst women. The disparity in anxiety rates are, the estimates vary, but they're usually between about 50 and 100% higher in women than in men. And there may well be some, you know, biological aspect to that. Maybe Adam can speak to that. But I can't help think that...
We're just prone to hysteria, us women, I think, aren't we?
Well, that's actually a great example. Because, I think, you know, hysteria was an anxious condition. And I think to a large extent it was probably caused by the huge amount of pressure that women were under in Victorian England. And I think nowadays women are under much more exacting social demands in terms of what's expected from them, in terms of what they do, and, you know, to have a career, to be a great mom, you know, to look after their husband, to do all of the housework, and then to, you know, look fantastic as well. And I think all of that, I can't see how all of that stuff couldn't but have the effect of making women more anxious. Also, I think
To be fair, no. But back in my grandparents' era, I mean, women were, you know, they didn't have the same expectations as they did now. But women, half the women were medicated. They were all taking Valium, and, you know, Mother's Little Helper was in every second cupboard. Because we've had these discussions, and I think that there has always been anxiety. And I think there's always been anxiety in both men and women. I don't counsel people, obviously, but certainly when I wrote my book, the responses coming in from men and women were pretty even. And I just think that maybe men don't seek help as much. Maybe men don't talk about their anxiety as much.
That's,
I think,
quite
possible. The pressures on men in our society are tremendous too, because their roles are changing as well. And it used to be back in my grandmother's day that men would go to work, come home, you know, sit down, listen to the radio, eat the dinner that the wife prepared, and, you know, maybe pat the kids on the head. And now they're expected to have completely different roles with childcare and housework and everything. Women are expected to have careers and so on. But there's always been anxiety, and there will always be. You know, back in, you take it down 1,000 years ago, and people were didn't expect to live past childbirth, or you know, had to go and hunt woolly mammoth. That's probably a bit more than 1,000 years ago, but they had to hunt woolly mammoth for dinner. There've always been stresses, but just briefly, what you were saying about France and taking, you know, skinny models off the cover. I think we've lost that race. I don't think we can possibly, as a society, stem the tide of social media and images. You know, we live in an age where there's the globalisation of the media. All a French woman has to do is click on the computer and she's got images from all around the world and Hollywood and so on. I think it comes, unfortunately, and I wish it wasn't the case, but I think it comes down to the individual and our own filters and how we manage that information and how we manage social media and how we have the ability ourselves to shut off, because the world isn't going to slow down. And we have to deal with it.
Writer, columnist and self-described anxious person Kerry Sackville. She's joined in this discussion about anxiety by psychologist Adam Guastella, philosopher Nick Malpas and clinical psychotherapist and Buddhist Genevieve David. On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas. Time now for the Q&A session, where the audience at the St James Ethics Centre gets involved.
I'm interested to kind of get your ideas on this kind of cult of busyness, which I would say I think is a really big feeder of anxiety. I started doing mindfulness recently, and when I mentioned to people the idea of sitting still for 10 minutes, there's this panic at this idea of, could I do that? I don't think I could, when we have all this external stimulus. And yeah, I'd just be interested to see what you guys think of that.
Well, I read, again, one of the teachers said something wonderful that... we're all living as if we're riding in a train, going super fast. And when you know, when you're in a train, when you look out the window, you don't see very much. It's just this one big blur. So the importance of, you know, as you slow down, you begin to see everything more brightly, more colourfully, more detailed. So that's the idea of what mindfulness practice is to begin to see everything, feel things, even taste things. And burnout, when you have burnout, you can't taste things, or you can't listen, or you can't even read a book, or you reread the page 5 times, or you watch TV and you don't even know what you've been watching. So these are all signs that we're, you know, in that train. Now, we can't all just suddenly sit down and meditate like a Buddha, but what we can do is begin to slow down. And I think, you know, there are traditionally Buddhist practices like walking meditation, but we can all, it's all really, I mean, and I think forever, the contemplatives have gone out into the countryside or have taken a walk. Or it's about slowing down. I mean, we just need to turn off and stop, or just slow down. Maybe you can't stop. You know, our nervous systems are so wired that of course, we're not going to be able to just suddenly, it's like having fifth gear in a Formula One car and then putting the brakes on. That's what it's going to be like. And that's, so we just need to just slow down. That's what I would say.
Chris, we've got a question over there, yeah. The lady.
I was just interested. We've been a lot of conversation about control and how there's not a lack, you know, there's, that helps anxiety to be in control. I was just wondering about the question of, what about when you are in control and you still feel anxious, you know, that you're anxious then about the effects of your control?
You mean on other people, the effects of your control on other people? But I think it's, I think anxiety is forever about, you know, and as Nick mentioned as well, it's forever about the future. So even when you're feeling anxious in the present, you seem to have everything together and, you know, the house is organized. For me, it's, you know, when I'm anxious, the first thing I do is I clean the house. Which is often messy, but I clean the house, I tidy my paperwork, I empty my inbox, and that control in my environment helps to give me a semblance of control in my mind, and that helps me to calm down. But it's always about the next step, it's the next step. So it's, okay, this I've got in control, but I still can't control whether my kids are going to be okay, I still can't control what's going to happen with that piece that I submitted, I still can't control, you know, if my mum's health is okay. And it's an illusion, we're never ever going to be completely in control, and so worrying about how much you're in control is really just another, you know, way of acknowledging that you're not completely in control. And the only way, and this is where, you know, I'm not a Buddhist, but this is the what it all boils down to is to accept that level of discomfort that comes with feeling out of control, that level of discomfort that comes with uncertainty, because we can never achieve that. I spent half my life, more than half my life, the first 40 years of my life, trying desperately to get to that kind of apex, that pinnacle of, yes, I'm here, I'm in control. And I never got there, but even if I had, it would have been for 10 seconds and then something else would have happened. So it's just accepting that, okay, everything's messy, everything's always going to be messy, I have to learn to sit with it. And I agree. I mean, the slowing down and the taking time out and the cult of business. I mean, that to me, that's just symptomatic of this anxiety that I have to be doing this, I have to be doing that. Everybody can stop sometimes. I spend a lot of time just sitting, staring at the ceiling, which is my own kind of meditation.
I think a lot of people think if they reach a certain goal, if they do a certain thing, their anxiety will be okay and they'll be happy. And we know that, I see clients all the time that develop job lists and to-do lists and structure everything, and then they do the task and they have trouble sitting to do the task that they've set, the job lists or the task that they do. They think that when they reach that exam result, they get that grade, they meet that person, that things are going to be, sorted then. And I think we spend a lot of time, looking for hedonistic rewards and things that are going to make us happy, and the internet and movies and what's going to happen tonight and tomorrow in that short-term approach. I mean,
could I just comment on that? I mean, even when you're in control of what you're doing and the effects that you're having, you can still be anxious about whether what you're doing is the right thing. Yeah, so you might be totally in control and completely able to do what you're doing, but if what you're doing is the wrong thing, then you've got serious problems. And with the collapse of these traditional value structures, it's become increasingly uncertain whether we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing.
We've just got a question up the back.
It takes you back, I guess, to what we were discussing before, which was whether the government has sort of a moral duty to help stem the prevalence of anxiety. And I just wondered, obviously, religion isn't as common in Australia, at least. We're sort of claiming to be a secular society, but the school I went to, there was religion, and my mum chose for me not to go to that, but there's no alternative. It doesn't seem like we've replaced it with anything, like an ethics conversation or anything, and I just wondered if you thought that was a good idea or...
I think that's a fantastic question. What can take the place of religion and give us a sense of value, a sense of meaning in the modern world? I think what you see in the existential thinkers like Heidegger and Sartre and so on is that the previous value systems that we had, religions, mythologies and so on, all rested on a certain kind of misapprehension about the way the world was, that there was just some authority out there that we could consult to tell us what the right answers were and how we should live our lives. Instead, figures like Heidegger and Sartre show you that, to a large extent, what is the right way to live is kind of up to you. Of course, you have to make those decisions within a certain social context, within a framework of values and norms and traditions that you receive from others. And that makes the process of ethical deliberation a lot more complicated. You can't just go and look it up in a book. You have to think, what are the values of my culture? Are those the right values? How would my action affect other people? What do I really want to get out of this? And that makes it all a lot more complicated. But yeah, I completely think that we should have more discussion about ethics, in the public sphere, in schools. Philosophy in schools, I think, would be a great thing. But whereas in a lot of religious, mythological, traditional systems, there are kind of clear-cut answers to these questions, I actually think that ethical questions often have very complicated answers.
So I have a question which builds on the question that was asked over there. And I guess there's an insight in psychoanalysis. It's just a rephrasing of things that have been said already, which is that anxiety comes from threats to the ego and attempts to reconstitute ego in terms of threats. but also the anxiety that comes from, like, what will the consequences be of the actions that I take when I try to reconstitute the ego, and will that alienate me from the people around me? Now, there have been a lot of, like, films recently, like, spoiler alert, guys, sorry, like The Avengers, like The Dark Knight Rises and Skyfall, which are about, like, capturing a villain. And then in the end, it turns out that, like, it actually puts us in a worse position because it was the villain's plans to be captured and it compromises what we're trying to achieve. Do you think that, like, it reflects on a wider anxiety we have these days, that, like, the solutions to a lot of our problems, and we do frame a lot of things in terms of, like, problem and solution these days, that those solutions are going to cause more problems or, like, reinforce the problems? And is that a source of anxiety?
Well, I just to comment on your cultural references, I think The Dark Knight Rises, and it's Iron Man 3, right, where he gets attacked and everything. Yeah, I think those are just great parables of male anxiety, of threats to male identity. I'm not saying that the male identity that's under attack is a good thing or anything. I'm just saying that they seem to be a manifestation.
Pitch Perfect was about the female identity being attacked, you know. But
I agree with you, actually, in terms of male identity being attacked. I think it is, and I see a lot of men in my practice. And I do think that there is a suffering, and it's really unpopular to say that, but I think there is a change. And I think men are not sure, you know, having a son who's 22, not sure of the rules anymore. What are the rules? What am I supposed to do? How do I go out on a date? Do I pay? Do I not? Do I have sex? Do I don't have sex? What, like, it's a free-for-all. And it's not a bad thing. It's not. There's no judgment here. But there's so much uncertainty, and I think that creates a lot of anxiety. And yeah,
so I've got a question here, and then here.
I was interested in what Genevieve was saying about women coming in who are anxious because maybe they haven't expressed their anger, and you know that we've been sort of told for ages that it's not okay to be angry. And I was just wondering if now it is not okay to suppress your anger. What is the right thing to do with the anger?
That's a good ethical
question. That's a really
good
question. Yeah. Look, I can only speak from personal experience of working with women, and I think it's the ethical. I think, you know, again, back to the Buddhism, the idea of non-harming, that is the primary thing, to help people and to not harm. And that's been really helpful. Not that I've ever harmed, but to have this principle. So it's not, and Buddhism, unlike many people think, it's not about not feeling anger. It's about getting to know your anger really well. And in psychotherapy, it's the same. Because you need to actually have felt it. You really need to feel yourself become alive with your anger, which is different to rage. Rage is sort of a reaction, and it's anger sort of out of control. But to really feel yourself is really important. So I would say, you know, I try to help people become aware of it, what it feels like, and that's the Buddhist part, becoming mindful of what it feels like in the body. What is this, like, on a somatic level? What does it feel like? Where do you feel it? What's your muscles doing? What's your stomach doing? You know, and then, well, what was that like? Have you ever been able, I mean, the whole story has been told or will be told about what it was like when they were younger. You know, for me, there's a story I have about excitement when my brother and I would rumble, and we get really excited, as kids can get really excited. My mother would always say, uh-oh, be careful, it's going to end in tears. Now, so for me, excitement is linked with fear, yeah? So as soon as I get excited about something...
Kids are socialized differently.
Yeah.
Because I write a lot about parenting,
right.
and you know, they've done studies even now, and they'll film boys and girls in exactly the same situation and listen to what their parents are saying to them. And a boy who is acting in a particular way will be called robust and energetic and vigorous, and the girl will be called disruptive and naughty. And so there are very different messages still, even though we think they're so open-minded and we think we have a culture of equality. Messages coming to boys and girls are still really different. And I think as parents, we have a long way to go in raising our kids so that girls can express emotions in the same way as boys and not be labelled differently. And then it will follow through.
I mean, I think that's part of the reason why I was struggling a little bit with the gender discussion earlier, because I think that we often, you know, we know that mental health problems generally are pretty even across the genders. And but through development, we know that the aggressive sort of acting out behaviours tends to be perpetrated a little bit more by males. And the internalising, turning on the self, the rates tend to be, the depression, the anxiety tends to be higher in females. Now, to say that the cause of that is totally different is a separate question, but the expression may be seen in different ways for different people.
I've just got one last, maybe two more questions, one up the front here.
So I've just actually got two parts to this question. So the first thing I wanted to ask was just in terms of anxiety, like we've talked a lot about control and things like that and percentage of women, male and female, but how much of that is to do with the number of people having anxiety and how much of that is to do with our awareness and our knowledge about what anxiety is? And the second part of the question is perhaps maybe if we taught our, you know, when coming down to teaching kids in an alternative to religion, perhaps if we taught them that vulnerability is okay and that this perception of normal, which seems to be in our society to be control and to have control is what we're trying to attain, is not necessarily what is required of us. And if perhaps we taught that, then there wouldn't be a need for an overarching God figure or a need for, and that it just is the human condition to be vulnerable and that it's okay to be vulnerable. And just so far in the discussion, I just haven't heard anybody touch on that, so I just wanted to ask.
You talk, what you're saying is exactly right, I would agree. And when we think about people who maybe being prepared to go into quite traumatic situations, a lot of it is around trying to establish a sense that you don't have control and preparing people for what might be coming. But I think, exactly what you say around the more you try and attain control and predict the outcome, the more likely you are to be vulnerable to anxiety.
But I would also say that the vulnerability that you're talking about, to be vulnerable, one has to feel safe. So you have to actually have this sense of true safety and acceptance and love, that you feel that you've been loved, yeah, as you are, not as anything else, which as a parent we know is incredibly difficult because we project and we without even knowing it, without wanting to. But I think that's so first, it's hard to just become vulnerable. You need to actually, Krista Neff has done a lot of work on self-compassion, and that's what she feels we need to bring into all the schools, which is basically, and she has, practices which are Buddhist based about, how to begin to like yourself as you are.
Could I just say, one of the great myths of modernity is the idea of the independent, autonomous, self-sustained individual who is completely in control of themselves. And that idea has historically been very gendered. That is, that kind of individual has been thought of as male, and women have been thought to lack this kind of control, this kind of autonomy, this kind of freedom, because they're, slaves to their passions or what have you. But over the last 30 years in philosophy, it's been very interesting to see the way in which conceptions of freedom and autonomy have started to accommodate vulnerability and relations to other people and our embodiment and the limits that poses to us. So I think, we have to think about freedom as it's intertwined with embodiment and vulnerability and dependence on others. And I think if we think about individuality and our own identities in that way, as being intertwined with others, as being open to others, open to the world, and therefore essentially vulnerable, I think that, could go some way to alleviating some kinds of anxiety.
We just got one last question here.
As a follow-on from the discussion in the dissolution of religion in society, that void in my reading seems to have been filled by a scientific approach to well-being and the human condition, and it seems to me now that we are coming to a stage with the advent of fMRI and Martin Seligman type stuff, that we are coming to a point where we can almost make absolute and objective decisions about what is good for the human condition cross-culturally, and wondering on your thoughts on maybe the dangers or the possibilities of that as a framework and a construct to guide you ethically, morally through your life.
I'm not a philosopher, but I spend a lot of time on social media, and I cannot imagine a day when everybody will agree on what's right for anybody, let alone the whole human condition, ever. I think we're still incredibly disparate in our ideas and our philosophies, and I think, in a sense, sometimes we're getting more and more fragmented. So I think that would be a lovely thing to say, but I don't believe there's any objective right or wrong about anything. There's just different opinions, and certainly that's what I see in my reading and in my interaction with people. I mean, I'm an opinion writer, so I write opinion pieces all the time, and I read a lot of opinion pieces, and there has never been one opinion piece, no matter how mild, no matter how inflammatory, that everybody is agreed on, ever. It doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what you write, there will be people who passionately agree, people who are in the middle, and people who passionately disagree. I cannot see ever anyone writing anything that everybody stands up and says, yep, you figured it out. So, as I said, I'd love that, but I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe I'm...
No, I agree. I mean, if you sit with yourself long enough just in a meditation, and haven't done it for years and years, but long enough to know that my mind changes all the time. And I imagine, just in preparing for today, oh, I could do this and I could do that. I mean, everything is changing all the time. I don't think I agree. I don't think we could agree.
I'm going to have to disagree with my two panelists and say,
I've proved the point.
I think you can say some objective things about what promotes human well-being in general. There will be some exceptions, individuals like psychopaths. Psychopaths don't benefit in any way from social interaction with other people. It's not really of any value to them for its own sake. It may be instrumentally valuable to them. But the things that we can say that are objectively good for human well-being are very general things. They're things like, connection to others, a sense of autonomy and control in directing your life, a feeling of, material security, that you have shelter and food for, into the foreseeable future. These are very general goods that all people need. Now, within those very general goods, whether somebody likes pizza or Thai food, whether they like playing badminton or football, whether they like playing video games or, doing oil paintings, those are all, that's all up for grabs, of course. Those are all just matters.
But also, how do they get the resources? And how much do they need? He might say he needs X much, and she might say she needs this much, and how do we how can we ever have some kind of paradigm or construct or formula where everybody gets exactly what they need and everybody is happy? It's just...
In principle, I think that could be worked out. It would just be incredibly complicated.
Well, if anyone could do it, you could do it.
I think you overestimate me.
Well, I think on that note, the ethics of anxiety, a lot of terrain we've crawled over this evening, and it feels like we could probably talk for a lot longer, but I'd just like our audience, thank you very much for coming along tonight, and also thank our panellists.
And our panellists at this St. James Ethics Centre discussion on anxiety were Genevieve David, President of the Australian Association of Buddhist Counsellors and Psychotherapists, Associate Professor Adam Guastella, a clinical psychologist and Principal Research Fellow at the Brain and Mind Research Institute at Sydney University, Nick Malpas teaches philosophy also at the University of Sydney, and Kerry Sackville is a columnist, social commentator, and author of The Little Book of Anxiety, Confessions from a Worried Life. Our thanks to moderator Jackie Dent, event curator at the St. James Ethics Centre, presenters of this evening's discussion. And that's it for Big Ideas for tonight. I'll be back with more Big Ideas tomorrow. Until then, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
This week on Future Tense, we take you to the 2015 Remix Summit in Sydney for a panel discussion entitled The Creative Revolution, exploring the transformation of content creation and distribution. What are the implications for culture? It's all about co-creation, audience engagement and monetization. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.